More vote counting, more conspiracy theories, more cabinet drama. Throw in Fidel Castro, and you have this week's edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin, and you thought the election was over? A recount of votes is underway in Wisconsin.
This is the first recount I've heard of here, at least, where it was a candidate who came in fourth place that requested a recount. So we are in a little bit of uncharted territory.
Plus, Fidel Castro died last week. The Cuban leader had been a thorn in every president's side since Eisenhower.
To halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated.
And we remember the horrific murders of the mayor and a city supervisor in San Francisco 38 years ago this week.
George Moscone was a liberal or progressive mayor. He was very popular. Harvey Milk, conceivably, and this, of course, was all retrospective, could have become the first gay mayor in America.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 156 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. President-elect Trump has made some progress in assembling his cabinet and administration, but whither is Secretary of State? That's where it's gotten messy. For some reason, Mitt Romney seems to be atop many of the lists, whatever those lists are worth. You remember Mitt Romney.
There's plenty of evidence that Mr. Trump is a con man, a fake. Mr. Trump has changed his positions, not just over the years, but over the course of the campaign. Donald Trump is a phony, a fraud. His promises are as worthless as a degree from Trump University.
And yet, Trump has summoned Romney for at least two meetings, ostensibly to talk about being Secretary of State. Is there an offer in the making? Not if Trump campaign manager Kellyanne Conway has a say in it. Here she is on CNN.
The number of people who feel betrayed to think that a Governor Romney would get the most prominent cabinet post after he went so far out of his way to hurt Donald Trump. There was the Never Trump movement, and then there was Mitt Romney. He gave speeches against Donald Trump. He attacked his character.
Personally, I can't imagine him picking Romney. It just feels like a setup, a deliberate hanging out to dry effort to get back at him. So if not Romney, then who? Rudy Giuliani wants it. Pretty badly, it appears. Here he was at a forum hosted by the Wall Street Journal.
The Wall Street Journal reported early this afternoon that the choice for Secretary of State in the Trump administration is down to Rudolph Giuliani and John Bolton. We don't have John Bolton here tonight, so I'm going to ask you some questions about...
John would be a very good choice.
Is there anybody better?
Maybe me, I don't know.
But there may be question marks over Giuliani's business ties around the world. Also on the list is retired general and former CIA director David Petraeus, who met with Trump on Monday. The problem with Petraeus, he pleaded guilty to mishandling classified material, showing his confidential diary to his biographer, with whom he was having an extramarital affair. Can you ignore Petraeus' record regarding classified material while having run a campaign hitting Hillary Clinton for allegedly doing the same thing? That reeks of hypocrisy, said Richard Painter, a former White House ethics lawyer under George W. Bush. It sure seems that way, doesn't it? All this cabinet intrigue leads to this week's trivia question. We all know that in 2008, Barack Obama named his chief intra-party rival, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State. When was the last time a Republican president named one of his primary opponents to his cabinet? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to the last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Consider your fate. There's no time to wait for your luck.
We're starting this week's program by repeating a Donald Trump tweet. You would think that after 155 episodes of The Political Junkie, we would know better by now. Well, welcome to the next 4 years. On Sunday, the president-elect tweeted this, quote, "In addition to winning the Electoral College in a landslide, I won the popular vote if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally," end of quote. I mentioned Trump's claim of millions of people voting illegally not because there's any validity to it. Fact checkers say that this is simply not true. It seems to be more about responding to the effort by Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential nominee, and belatedly joined by the Clinton campaign, to finance a bid for a recount in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, three states that, surprisingly, went for Trump. The margins were relatively narrow, under 11,000 in Michigan, about 22,000 in Wisconsin, and a more hefty 70,000 in Pennsylvania. But the results would have to be overturned in all three states for Clinton to win the election. That is not likely to happen. Even former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, a strong Clinton supporter, didn't sound enthusiastic about the idea in an interview on MSNBC with Andrea Mitchell.
I think since there was so much chatter about the possibility of Russia hacking the results, etc., it's probably worth someone doing a quick study to do the actual vote count and what the reports were. The statistical survey raises questions, but boy, it's a real long shot. I wouldn't do an election challenge unless I found in district after district that there was a significant difference between what the actual vote on the machine was and what the reported vote was.
And in fact, according to all the people at Homeland we talked to before the election, these machines are not online. These machines are all internally connected so that hacking would be nearly impossible, we were told at least by Homeland Security before the election.
That would be a persuasive argument for not doing an audit. But look, when someone raises a statistical study like this, it's probably a good idea to have someone look at it quick, down and dirty, not an election challenge, not a court challenge, but just to see if there's anything to these claims. My guess is there isn't. Look, no one wants Hillary Clinton to be president of the United States more than me. I think she'd have been a great president. No one was more disappointed than I was. But, I don't think this is worth any full-scale audit, but I think we can take a look at some divisions and see if there's any disparity. My guess is there probably wouldn't be, or if it's a disparity, it's, as you said, small enough that it wouldn't make a difference.
Trump's claim of millions of illegal votes, added to his equally suspicious declaration that there was massive fraud in California, Virginia, and New Hampshire, three states that, guess what, went for Clinton, is more than just a response to the Stein-Clinton recount effort. It also comes after he spent most of the campaign warning of a rigged election, that they, are out to steal the election away from him. Before we speculate any further, let's talk to Michael Haas. He's the administrator for the Wisconsin Elections Commission and will be handling the state's recount. Mike, it's great to have you on The Political Junkie.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Ken.
Well, tell me, how does one go about getting a recount in Wisconsin?
Well, we have a statewide recount here, and all it takes is for one of the candidates on the ballot to file a simple petition with us, and in a case where the margin is more than 0.25%, which is the case here, that candidate has to pay the full cost of the recount, and we will reimburse the counties for their costs after the recount is done.
So you're saying that whether the margin was 200 votes, 22,000 votes, or 200,000 votes, it doesn't matter. As long as a person is a candidate on the ballot, he or she can request a recount, and that's all there is?
Exactly. Although I would say this is the first recount I've heard of here, at least, where it was a candidate who came in fourth place that requested a recount and received 30,000 votes out of almost 3 million casts. So we are in a little bit of uncharted territory.
And what is the current margin between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton?
On election night, the unofficial results, the press reported about a 27,000-vote margin. After the official canvasses came in from the county, that margin is just a little over 22,000 votes.
So there was 5,000. Were they disqualified because they were all written in Russian?
You know, we always stress that election night results are unofficial results for the very reason that we don't know what the press is reporting, where they're getting it from. And we don't tabulate those results at the state level. And this is a good example of the need to be patient until the official results are tabulated and sent in. Fortunately, it was not a razor-thin margin, so that 5,000-vote figure did not affect any of the results.
I see, you know, Jill Stein, who is the candidate who initiated this recount, not only in Wisconsin, but also Michigan and Pennsylvania. She obviously, there's a lot of money. She's talking about trying to raise millions and millions of dollars. What does it cost to go through a recount in Wisconsin?
Well, that was largely unknown until the past couple of days. So we requested or required actually a recount fee of $3.5 million for the statewide recount from the Stein campaign. We received it on Tuesday. The deadline was 4:30 p.m. and the funds came through at about 4:25 p.m. So a few minutes to spare. We had actually had a statewide recount in 2011 for a Supreme Court race, probably half of the votes. And the clerks had reported at that time that their costs were in the $500,000 range. And we just had no idea of how much it would be for a statewide recount of a presidential contest with about 3 million votes. We asked the county clerks to give us an estimate. We totaled that up and provided it to the Stein campaign. That campaign was required to pay us a fee before we could issue the recount order, which we have done for the recount to start on Thursday. If there are funds remaining after the local units of government are reimbursed, the balance would be returned to the campaign. If the initial fee does not cover the costs, then they will be on the hook for the additional costs.
You mentioned that 2011 recount. Did that change the results of the election?
It did not. We had about 1.5 million votes. The number of ballots that actually switched was about 300. So that was a pretty small percentage of votes that changed from the initial official canvass to the recount canvass.
With your knowledge, do you know of any recount that's ever changed the results of an election or the early results? Initial results of an election in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's probably more common when you have local races, of course, where, you know, often races will be decided by one or two votes if you have a school board race or city council or mayoral race. And it's not unusual in those contests in the spring for us in Wisconsin to have a number of local recounts. And it's not unusual to see them end up in a tie. And then they're decided by some game of chance, drawing cards or flipping a coin or something like that. We have actually a recount going on now for a state legislative seat, a state Senate seat. That margin was about 56 votes, I believe. And the four counties involved in that contest are recounting the ballots now. I think it's probably more common that the original result stands up. But it's not unprecedented, of course, for the second-place finisher to end up winning the recount.
You mentioned that the presidential recount begins on Thursday. What does that entail? Are there election officials around the country? Are there county boards? Local? Who are the people who are doing this recount?
Right. So in Wisconsin, first of all, we have what we call the most decentralized election administration system in the country because our elections are run at the municipal level by 1,854 municipal clerks. Most counties run their elections at the county level, or most states run their election at the county level. But when it comes to recount, each county has a canvass board, the three-person board that certified the official results. So that canvass board in each county will reconvene. They will give public notice. It's open to the public. They will reconvene, decide which method they will use to tally the ballots and the votes. And then they will proceed. Some counties will be done in 1 or 2 days. We have a lot of smaller population rural counties in Wisconsin. Some counties like Milwaukee County, Dane County where Madison is, Brown County where Green Bay is, they may struggle a little bit to finish this recount by our deadline of December 12th.
I was going to say the Electoral College is set to cast its votes on December 19th, so you're confident that you'll have an answer, a definitive answer about Wisconsin's numbers before then?
That's what we've directed. It's been a little bit of a civics lesson, schoolhouse rock, to get back into how the Electoral College works. But there is a federal law that establishes a date of December 13th. If the recount continues beyond that date, under that federal law, Congress would not be required to honor the results. The presidential electors meet in every state on December 19th, but that federal law does not say that the results would have to be rejected. That it just provides a safe harbor where if the recount is finished, Congress is required to honor the electoral slate that was chosen by the voters.
I never heard of the Wisconsin Elections Commission before. Did it play a role at all in the recall effort attempt against Governor Walker?
So that was our predecessor agency, the Government Accountability Board. The Wisconsin Elections Commission only came into being on June 30th of this year. The legislature last year passed a law to disband it and divide its duties between the new Elections Commission and a new Ethics Commission, which regulates campaign finance and lobbying laws. And so we had a really significant transition. Most of the staff is the same. Our daily duties and responsibilities haven't changed. We have a really strong working relationship with our local clerks, and that, of course, has not changed. But there still has been an administrative transition, all of the back office things that have to take place to establish a new agency. So that has been a little bit of an extra challenge because at that time, our August partisan primary was already taking place. Absentee ballots had been issued, and so we needed to keep our eye on the ball to be able to administer the election while we are trying to successfully transition to a new agency.
I know this is probably above your pay grade, but would you like to venture a guess on what the response might be if the recount gave Hillary Clinton the victory in Wisconsin?
That would be a surprise. When we had our court hearing for the Jill Stein campaign's request to hand count, they needed to make a case that a hand count of the ballots would be more reliable and would have a substantial likelihood of leading to a change in the results of the election. And the judge did not find that was the case. But just as a political spectator and junkie myself, I think that would certainly create a stir. We don't know yet if Michigan and Pennsylvania are going to join us in a recount, but at this point, it seems that the focus in the spotlight is on Wisconsin again, and we've had quite a bit of that in the last 5 or 6 years.
And if Jill Stein wins all three states, that would be remarkable too, wouldn't it?
It certainly would, yes.
Mike Haas is the administrator for the Wisconsin Elections Commission, responsible for handling the presidential recount in the Badger State. Mike, thanks so much for your time.
All right, thanks for having me, Ken. I appreciate it.
Well, I've been thinking about all the places we surfed and danced and all the faces we missed. So let's get back together and do it again.
Fidel Castro died last week. The longtime Cuban president slash revolutionary slash dictator was 90 years old. He had given up power to his younger brother, Raul, a decade ago as his health worsened. Fidel Castro first came to power in 1959, and he bedeviled every American president since Eisenhower. In 1962, he was the spark that nearly brought the U.S. and the Soviet Union to war. In the past 50-plus years, the U.S. relationship with Castro and Cuba has gone from hostility to containment to, with President Obama, a bid for openness. Throughout it all, he has always frustrated, bewildered, and infuriated Washington. Patrick Haney is the chair of the Political Science Department at Miami University in Ohio. He's also the author of The Cuban Embargo, Domestic Politics of American Foreign Policy. Professor Haney, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Fidel Castro is dead. Now, you knew it would have happened one day, but it's strange to actually hear those words.
Yeah, it's one of those things that was bound to happen, right? And yet at some point when it doesn't happen and it doesn't happen, you think, well, gee, maybe it won't happen. But it did. I guess it always catches you by surprise. And to have it happen really in the midst of this election season probably is only appropriate, that with everything else that's up in the air, about the future direction of American foreign policy. We knew Cuba was going to be up in the air based on some of the things that candidate Trump said. To then throw this into the mix, too, adds to the level of uncertainty. So it's probably just about the right time.
How would you describe the role that Cuba played in U.S. foreign policy basically for the past half century?
Well, certainly since the 80s, I would say, others have said, one might even argue that not only did we have a foreign policy toward Cuba, but we also had a Florida policy during election seasons, which was that sort of where candidates stood on the issue of the embargo would help define to what extent they could get Florida's electoral votes to be in play or not. And so I think that one of the things that is so fascinating about U.S. foreign policy toward Cuba and what drew me to this topic and my co-author on the book when we started working on some things on this, Latin Americanist, was just how peculiar this policy area is. And not that all foreign policy isn't at some level, you know, a piece of domestic politics, but man, the Cuban embargo is really square in the middle of American politics. It's, you know, as you headed into the 80s and the Cold War sort of heated up during the Reagan years, the domestic politics of the Cuban embargo also really ratcheted up. And they stayed there up through, I think, Obama's first election. And that's another thing that's so fascinating about this is that there was the appearance in Obama's election and in the reelect that maybe that dynamic was now gone, that the generational change in the community in South Florida, but also the demographic shifts in Florida that brought the relative percentage of Latino voters that the Cuban Americans made up, brought that down, which made that voting bloc less significant in some ways, that maybe those dynamics were gone. But I think there's every reason to believe from 2016 that they're not gone yet.
As you were saying that, I was thinking how U.S. Mideast and policy and policy towards Israel, how that would always play out in New York politics, and how U.S. policy towards Cuba always played out in Florida politics. But as you say, as the anti-Castro immigrants got older and died off, that fervor, that intensity seemed to die off as well.
Yeah, and I mean, it plays out in New Jersey too, but you see it, I think, in some ways more in terms of being able to shift where a state ends up in the electoral college. It's more significant down in Florida. But, you know, it's interesting that you'd use the Israel example because, you know, during the Reagan campaign for his first election, I think it was either in late 1979 or early 1980, one of the things that they did was to try and create some inroads with the Cuban-American community down in Miami with Jorge Mascanosa and some others and try and suggest, you know, that this group that had been in many ways, you know, waging a war against Castro on the streets of Miami needed to shift its focus to Washington, and that if they could help Ronald Reagan get elected to the White House, that they'd have a real partner there to put real heat on Havana. I mean, they kind of believe that the pathway went from Moscow to Havana and then to Managua in Nicaragua. And so let's get the heat focused there. And one of the examples that they gave to the Cuban Americans when they were trying to get themselves organized politically to lobby in Washington was AIPAC, to say, you know, look at the model of AIPAC and organize yourselves that way. And indeed, the Cuban American National Foundation was then born and organized in much the same way that AIPAC as an organization was created.
When I think of Reagan's policy towards Cuba and his rhetoric about Castro, I also think back, of course, to President Kennedy. And I guess, I mean, he was bedeviled by Castro in Cuba throughout his administration. But it seems like, with some exceptions, maybe Jimmy Carter, but for some exceptions, that we've had Democrats and Republicans as president. But the U.S. policy, for the most part, has been the same, no?
That's right. So what changed, I think, and why I sort of tack it to the 80s is, after the Bay of Pigs, the bloc of Cuban-American voters across the country, but especially in New Jersey and in South Florida, and for purposes of shifting the Electoral College, especially in Florida, had written off the Democrats. There was really nothing that any Democrat could do that was going to make significant inroads in that community. And so while, you know, Hispanic voters would go, you know, majority, more, even two-thirds toward Democrats, Cuban-American voters would be 90% Republican from the Bay of Pigs really on and up through Reagan.
You mentioned earlier that that the Democrats basically lost the Cuban vote in the aftermath of the Bay of Pigs. I have three pieces of tape that I want to play only because I just think it's just, I mean, if I think, when I think of American politicians being tough on Castro, tough on Cuba, I don't think I found as rhetoric as hard on Castro as I did from JFK. Let me play for the first one. This is from the fourth Kennedy-Nixon debate of 1960, where Kennedy almost seems to be suggesting that the Eisenhower administration was ignoring the communist threat around Castro. Let me play that.
I look at Cuba, 90 miles off the coast of the United States. In 1957, I was in Havana. I talked to the American ambassador there. He said that he was the second most powerful man in Cuba. And yet, even though Ambassador Smith and Ambassador Gardner, both Republican ambassadors, both warned of Castro, the Marxist influences around Castro, the communist influences around Castro, both of them have testified in the last 6 weeks that in spite of their warnings to the American government, nothing was done. Our security depends upon Latin America. Can any American looking at the situation in Latin America feel contented with what's happening today?
And then here's Kennedy as president shortly after the failed invasion during the Bay of Pigs.
When I want it clearly understood that this government will not hesitate in meeting its primary obligations, which are to the security of our nation. Should that time ever come, we do not intend to be lectured on intervention by those whose character was stamped for all time on the bloody streets of Budapest. Secondly, it is clear that this nation, in concert with all the free nations of this hemisphere, must take an ever closer and more realistic look at the menace of external communist intervention and domination in Cuba. The American people are not complacent about Iron Curtain tanks and planes less than 90 miles from their shore. But a nation of Cuba's size is less a threat to our survival than it is a base for subverting the survival of other free nations throughout the hemisphere.
So I'm thinking of those two clips of the candidate John F. Kennedy in 1960, President Kennedy in 61. And then, of course, you remember the address to the country, the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62. And it's, I mean, I can't think of an American politician, U.S. politician, that was tougher, or at least sounded tougher, on Castro and communism than John Kennedy.
Well, in that fourth debate, I mean, all of those presidential debates in 1960, you know, are just, they're such great period pieces. I mean, I beg students to go back and just watch the introductory statements by both candidates in those debates. They would go on for 5 minutes each, you know, in perfectly formed sentences. In some sense, you know, been lost over time, probably not for the better. But they, you know, those candidates disagreed about very little on foreign policy in that campaign. They were both hardened cold warriors. Kimoy and Matsu, offshore islands. They had some debate about who might, you know, handle that harder than others, and you know, Kennedy there, as you played about Cuba. I think in the eyes of Cuban Americans, when Kennedy refused to follow up the Bay of Pigs operation with conventional military forces, that his words kind of fell hollow for them. Now, I don't know that it had quite the same effect for others as it did for Cuban Americans, in that sense that those might have been hollow talk about Cuba. And I think it is worth pointing out that the record is clear that we certainly did try through other means to remove Fidel Castro over the years through the 1960s and early 1970s, but not through the use of overt military force, which is what a lot of people wanted.
But even if the embargo, I mean, if ostensibly the embargo was designed to either weaken Castro or end communism, that didn't seem to work either. I mean, they were still here. The Castro still run the country 50 years later.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the whole idea of these embargoes, I suppose, is that, you know, you make people hurt enough that they want to overthrow their leader. In this particular case, I think, you know, most people's view is that what Castro was able to do was sort of turn things from being a sort of domestically sort of a communist leader you know, sort of foreign to the national experience of the place toward a nationalist leader and blame the Yankee imperialists for their plight. And it worked. And so I think a lot of people said, you know, this thing isn't going to work, especially if it's not more multilateral. It's a unilateral embargo or nearly unilateral embargo. It's hard to really make that thing bite in the way that it needs to. You know, I think the movement had been going toward more normalization. I think that view that says, hey, look, this is a relic, this thing's not working, it's time for a new day, had been winning on bipartisan levels, too, winning.
And that basically is what President Obama said when he addressed the nation in December of 2014.
Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba. In the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries.
Let me just end this discussion by reminding you and everybody else that two things happened in November. Yes, Fidel Castro died, but Donald Trump was elected president. So I suspect in many ways Trump's victory may be the bigger story. Either way, what changes between the U.S. and Havana?
Well, certainly the path that we were heading down slows. You know, I think it's not hard to imagine, had Hillary Clinton won, that one of the things that President Obama would have done during the lame duck was try and get an ambassador approved. That's not going to happen now. And I think there are a lot of steps that President Obama took that are done with the stroke of a presidential order that a President Trump might well decide to turn back. And we'd kind of gotten used to that. Clinton loosened and then Bush tightened and then Obama loosened again. But I think the depth of the engagement and the speed with which that's happened, it is going to be difficult for President Trump to shut all of that down, especially because there's a lot of Republicans in the House. There's a lot of Republican governors that don't want to see that shut down. But, you know, at the end of the day, he owes some of his core constituency for turning out to vote for him. And one of them appears to be Cuban Americans in South Florida that turned out at a much higher rate for him than they had for Romney. They turned out in, you know, much higher rate as a percentage of all Latino voters. And so I would expect that Trump's going to try and slow this thing down a bit. But, I think that there's no doubt that there's some changes going on the island already. And so I think, you know, thinking about what happens in Cuba as only being driven by the U.S. is a mistake. They've got their own dynamics going on there, and the passage of Fidel may be a more significant event for them than the election of Trump, whereas for us, the election of Trump is probably more significant than the passing of Fidel. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out over the next 18 months.
Pat Haney is the chair of the Political Science Department at Miami University in Ohio and the author of The Cuban Embargo, Domestic Politics of American Foreign Policy. Pat, thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. Tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be all right?
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question, which was, while many White House chiefs of staff have run for public office, who was the last one to have been elected statewide? The answer, John Sununu. The White House chief of staff under the first President Bush, he served 3 2-year terms as governor of New Hampshire between 1983 and 1988. And the randomly selected winner is Jim McComb of San Dimas, California. Jim wins the coveted Political Junkie button. And we have a new Scuttlebutton puzzle winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. In last week's contest, the first button read, Column E, Save Hudson County. That's from New Jersey. Then came a button that read, Make the Check to Leck. a button for Lech Walesa, the Polish leader who addressed a joint session of Congress in 1989. Then a 1972 Democratic Convention button promoting the Doral Country Club in Miami Beach. And finally, a button from New York University. So when you combine E with Lech with Doral and that NYU button, you kind of get the Electoral College, which votes to officially elect the next president on December 19th. The winner is Fern Zalen Jones of Valencia, California. As always, check out our website for the latest campaign updates, scuttlebutt and puzzles, political columns, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, where you can make the check to Ken. Go to krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. This event, 38 years ago this week, was one of the most horrific acts of political violence imaginable. Here was David Brinkley on NBC's Nightly News.
George Moscone, the mayor of San Francisco, was shot dead in his office in City Hall this morning. So was Harvey Milk, a city supervisor. Both shot, both murdered. The police arrested Dan White, a one-time city supervisor who had resigned and wanted Moscone to reappoint him, but he had not agreed to do so.
The assassinations of Moscone and Milk shocked a city already grieving from the murder of Congressman Leo Ryan, a close Moscone ally, by followers of cult leader Jim Jones in Guyana days earlier, along with the subsequent mass suicides in Jonestown. Back at City Hall, it was Dianne Feinstein, then the president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, who made the official announcement.
Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
Oh,
the suspect, the supervisor Dan White.
Mike Weiss covered the assassinations and the trial of Dan White for the Los Angeles Times, and is the author of Double Play, The Hidden Passions Behind the Double Assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk. Mike Weiss, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Well, thanks. It's good to be here.
I mentioned this in the intro, but the city was already mourning the killing of Congressman Ryan and the some 904 suicides of the followers of Jim Jones. The city was really like besides itself, wasn't it?
It was an extraordinary dark time. I've never lived through anything quite like it. I mean, I lived through both Kennedy assassinations and the murder of Martin Luther King, but this was very local and it touched people in a very personal way. The thing that really brought it home to me on the day of the assassinations, I took a streetcar. I was actually working at Time Magazine, which had its offices downtown, and I took a streetcar home to my apartment in an outlying neighborhood, and the whole way home, it was about a 20-minute ride, nobody spoke a single word. People were just struck mute by what was going on. It was just unfathomable.
In a nutshell, tell us first who George Moscone was, and then talk a little bit about the relationship between Harvey Milk and Dan White.
Well, George Moscone was a liberal or progressive mayor who was elected by putting together a coalition of minorities and neighborhood groups for the most part, plus many traditional Democrats. And as a mayor, he was very popular. He was also a bon vivant. He was often seen around town driving his own small Alfa Romeo, as his very good friend Willie Brown once said about George. George's only problem is that when he has two drinks, he thinks he's invisible. And as I say, he was well-liked and allied with Harvey Milk and the other more liberal supervisors against a smaller bloc to which Dan White belonged, of more conservative supervisors, which is what we call the city council here, Board of Supervisors. You asked about the relationship between Harvey and Dan. It was a very complex relationship. They sat quite close to each other in board meetings. Harvey had a sharp wit, and he and another supervisor named Carol Ruth Silver used to make fun of Dan. And I'm sure that hurt because Dan was very much out of his element. He had no background in politics whatsoever when he was elected to the Board of Supervisors. On the other hand, their relationship, as I said, was complex because they were both outsiders who came down to City Hall. And in a certain way, Dan seemed to admire Harvey. Harvey was the only supervisor he invited to his son's christening. And at that christening, Dan said to one of his uncles, "I want you to meet Harvey. He's my best friend at City Hall." So I could go on and on about the relationship. But as I say, it seemed to be a very complicated relationship between the two of them. But politically, it was very clear. Harvey Milk didn't want Dan White on the Board of Supervisors, and he worked hard after Dan White resigned his seat to make sure that Mayor Moscone would not reappoint Dan White when he changed his mind and said no, he wanted his seat back. And Dan was aware of that because he walked into a city attorney's office while the city attorney was on the phone with Harvey Milk, and Harvey Milk was discussing the options available to prevent Dan White from getting his seat back. So
basically we had Dan White killing both Moscone, who refused to allow him to rescind his resignation, and Harvey Milk, who didn't want him back at all.
He felt betrayed by Harvey. He felt in his own very naive way that they were friends, and that he didn't seem to understand that that in the context of who was going to be on the Board of Supervisors, which was divided 5-4, his seat really mattered, that it was politics and not any personal relationship that would determine where each of the other supervisors came down.
When you said divided 5-4, you mean between more business conservative elements and the more liberal, right?
Until Dan quit, there were 5 conservatives and 4 liberals. But when he quit, obviously, Moscone now had the opportunity to completely change that balance to 5-4 the other way, kind of like the Supreme Court in the most recent election.
Harvey Milk, of course, is now known nationally as a pioneer in the gay rights movement. A movie was made of him. He's a larger-than-life figure. But how did San Francisco see him back then? What was his reputation like?
Well, I mean, he wasn't that well-known. I mean, the supervisors aren't. The city had instituted a district election system, which is why political unknowns like Harvey and Dan could be elected with very few votes just from their own small district. Until then, there had been citywide elections. He was seen as amusing and progressive. His best known moment came when he was promoting a pooper law, you know, pick up your dog's leavings, and to do that, he stepped into a pile of dog poop, and there was a famous picture of him showing off the dog poop on the bottom of his foot. But he was a serious politician who had been trying for a number of years to get elected to an important city office, and he was seen as somebody who conceivably, and this of course was all retrospective, conceivably could have become the first gay mayor in America.
How did the gay community react to his killing?
Well, it's the killing with mourning and anger, to the verdict with anger. When Dan White was found guilty only of manslaughter, despite the fact that it seemed quite apparent to everybody that he had very cold-bloodedly assassinated these two men, there was a riot in front of City Hall, and 9 police cars were burned. City Hall itself came under physical attack. Windows were smashed. It was the most interesting riot I'd ever seen. I'd been in a number of riots as a reporter. This one was a sort of an all-out fight. The cops and primarily middle-class gay guys were really felt terribly abandoned and unprotected after that verdict, literally fought in the streets. It was extraordinary.
Do you have any insight of why he was convicted of manslaughter and not murder?
Well, sure. I mean, he had a brilliant defense. It was a diminished capacity defense. And there were two defense lawyers, Doug Schmidt and Steve Scher. And the strategy was that they admitted from the beginning of the first moment of the trial, they admitted that Dan White had done the deed. There was no question that he had killed these two men. And Schmidt, who was the person who was the more visible of the two lawyers, said, okay, our guy has done it, but look at who he is. He's a good man. He's been a cop. He's been a firefighter. He served in the armed forces. He has a wife. He has kids. He's never been in any trouble. So the question isn't did he do it, but why did he do it? And the proposition they put forth was that he had an underlying depression of a clinical nature. They called a whole bunch of psychiatrists to testify in to that, and also that under the pressure of the moment and a variety of other pressures in his life, he had simply snapped.
Wasn't there that infamous Twinkie defense? What was that all about?
Just before I get to the Twinkie defense, let me only say that that argument might have been lost on a different jury, but the prosecutor in this case, a man named Tommy Norman, impaneled a jury of primarily white middle-aged to late middle-aged women because he had been a very successful prosecutor with just those kinds of juries. But he was now prosecuting an entirely different kind of man, and those jurors were very sympathetic to someone like Dan White, who came from the same milieu they did, and who could easily have been the son of half the jury members. But to go ahead to your question, what was the next question?
I just remember when you were talking about how good his defense was. I remember them talking about that the Twinkie defense. And
oh, the Twinkie defense. Well, there was no such thing as that. Well, Paul Krasner, who is a satirist, came up with that phrase. And it was a brilliant phrase to encapsulate the notion that Dan was very depressed and that one indication of his depression was, though he was normally a healthy eater, or so his defense claimed, he was instead gorging on cupcakes and donuts and Cokes and Twinkies. But it was a wonderful phrase that Paul came up with, and it stuck in the popular imagination, but it actually had very, very little to do with the trial or its outcome.
Let me go back to one thing about Dianne Feinstein. At the time, she was a two-time failed candidate for mayor. And then, of course, she became mayor with Moscone's death because she was head of the Board of Supervisors. What was the view of Feinstein before that horrible day? I mean, now she's been in the Senate since 1992, but who was Dianne Feinstein?
She had told friends that after her two unsuccessful attempts to become mayor that she was going to retire from politics. If it hadn't been, and she's always been very open about this, that it completely changed the course of her career. She stepped in at a traumatic moment. She handled it very well with a great deal of empathy and a very solid approach to things, and it catapulted her into becoming the most powerful politician in California for several decades now. That was one of the important consequences of these killings. Another important consequence was that the state legislature moved to eliminate the diminished capacity defense because it had fallen into such bad repute because of the Twinkie defense. But the third and probably the most significant of the consequences was a completely unintended consequence, which is to say that with Harvey being martyred, there began a much wider spread acceptance of gay people, leading ultimately to gay marriage. Harvey, I think it's fair to say, was far more influential in death than he would have been in life. And, you know, Dan White is more or less forgotten. Most people don't really know who he is. George Moscone has his name on a couple of public buildings, but like most former mayors in any city, he too is kind of faded into history. But Harvey and his name will live forever.
Mike Weiss covered both the murders and the trial in San Francisco and has written a book on the subject, Double Play. Mike, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Ken. I appreciate your calling me. Take care.
It was 38 years ago this week, on November 27, 1978, when San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk were assassinated in their City Hall offices by Dan White, a city supervisor who had resigned but then tried in vain to get his job back. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. Before we go, we want to note that Democrats in the House have decided to keep Nancy Pelosi as their leader. Pelosi is 76 years old and has been criticized by some in her party for missing the message of Midwest blue-collar voters, those who went for Donald Trump on Election Day. Pelosi missed more than that, as noted here.
Donald Trump is not going to be president of the United States. Take it to the bank. Okay. I guarantee it. Donald Trump is the here today, gone tomorrow candidate for president of the United States. Donald Trump is not going to be president of the United States.
Oh, well. On Wednesday, Pelosi defeated her Democratic rival, Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio, by a vote of 134-63. That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.